This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. Last month, the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs announced an initiative to expedite compensation claims for disability for veterans who've waited 1 year or longer. L.C. Morris has more.
The Veterans Administration is implementing a comprehensive transformation plan, a series of people, process, and technology initiatives to increase productivity and accuracy of disability claims processing. The goal of the plan is to eliminate the backlog of claims of 1 year and older by 2015. Most initiatives brought on behalf of our veterans are greeted with optimism, but some remain skeptical of the transformation plan.
I'm not sure that it is attainable. I'm sure that they will give a valiant effort for it to be attainable, but I'm not sure.
Amelia Grissett is the director of the Onslow County Veteran Services.
They're stating that they are planning to target claims that are over a year by 2015, where we have a great number of claims already over a year, 12 and 18 months and 24 months is what we're seeing in decisions right now.
While the Veterans Administration completed a record-breaking 1 million claims per year over the past 3 years, the number of claims received continues to exceed the number processed, and the backlog of claims has grown. Douglas Bradley, who spent 20 years in the United States Marine Corps, is going through the process now.
In the month of January 2012, I had everything completed at the QTC building on Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. Everything was ready to be turned in. I just needed to hit my final EAS, and at that point, it's sent off to the VA, and it was, and it's in limbo.
Bradley, who suffers from traumatic brain injury from a non-combat situation, was prompted by his fellow Marines to start the process of getting disability benefits as early as possible.
All your examinations, your paperwork, get it filed, things of that nature, to ensure that the process goes as smooth as it can for you, because I was being told that if you're missing any information, nobody's going to tell you you're missing any information. They're just going to leave your file on a desk somewhere, and whenever your stuff gets there, it gets there.
Bradley's last active day was in April of 2012, and his initial rating has yet to be assigned.
I can't get any answers from the VA. I've done numerous inquiries. I sent a congress through Walter B. Jones. I should be hearing something back from them hopefully this week as to why my stuff is ready to be rated, but it's still sitting up in Baltimore, Maryland. I get the same generic response whenever I call the VA. It's in the development phase.
There are currently 3.9 million veterans in the United States receiving disability benefits from the Veterans Administration. In the past 4 years, the VA has added more than 940,000 veterans to the VA compensation rolls, more than the active duty Army and Navy combined. Grissett says with such a caseload demands particular training.
I welcome any action also that the VA could do to try to help with this backlog of claims. I do welcome that. However, in providing claims and decisions, that is such a specific job that it would seem to me that additional staff would have to be hired to take care of this backlog of claim, and someone to rate a claim, that is a position that takes a year or more than a year of training. There is my concern as to whether or not they have enough trained people.
Effective April 19th of this year, the Department of Veterans Affairs says VA claim raters will make provisional decisions on the oldest claims in inventory, which will allow veterans to begin collecting compensation benefits more quickly if eligible. Veterans would be able to submit for consideration a full year after the provisional rating before the VA issues a final decision. Grissett says while all of this is great news, the system is in still need of repair.
There are some things that we're seeing a long period of time for decisions, such as what we would call simple things like adding a dependent. It is taking an extremely long time, sometimes up to a year just to add a dependent, which is, that seems to be something that would be a little bit more easier.
In April, U.S. Senator Kay Hagan continued her efforts to end the VA disability claims backlog by urging action from President Obama. Hagan joined 66 of her colleagues in sending a letter to the president, urging him to take direct action to end the backlog, which has prevented more than 65,000 veterans in North Carolina from receiving their benefits they are due. In March, Hagan sent a letter to Veteran Affairs Secretary Eric Shinseki, stating that the delays for veterans in North Carolina have only gotten worse. It takes an average of 341 days to process claims at the Veterans Benefits Administration's claims office in Winston-Salem. The office, which handles most North Carolina cases, including those from Fayetteville and the Cape Fear region, has the second longest wait time in the agency's southeastern region. In a statement after the announced initiative, Hagan said, "The initiative marks a step in the right direction for the VA. More must be done to reduce the wait times North Carolina veterans face." I'm L.C. Morris.
A bill requiring North Carolina educators to teach that abortions are linked to later premature births has tentatively passed the state Senate. House Bill 132 will return for another Senate vote. It will head to the House if it clears the Senate. The bill would require health instructors teaching students in the 7th grade and older to include information about what the bill calls preventable causes of preterm birth, including induced abortion. North Carolina Public Radio's Jessica Jones reports.
One of the legislature's biggest committee rooms was overflowing with spectators who gathered to hear what lawmakers had to say about House Bill 132. The measure's sponsor, Republican Senator Warren Daniel, told the room the bill is about giving young people scientific information about future health risks associated with abortion.
It's a bill based on science. It's not based on political ideology. We educate our children on the risks of cigarette smoking. We educate our children on the risks of drinking and other hazardous behaviors, and this is just a bill that's based on the scientific evidence that shows that you will have a future risk of premature birth if you decide voluntarily to have an abortion.
Anti-abortion advocates of the General Assembly have passed out studies for years they maintain link premature births to past abortions. The Senate Health Committee invited UNC School of Medicine pediatrics professor Marty McCaffrey to run through a few of those studies and speak about his own experiences.
Some of the mothers of preterm babies I care for, tortured at their bedsides as they maintained vigils with their preterm infants for months, asked the question, why? What could I have done to make this different? They know nothing about the association of preterm birth with the abortion that they may have had months or years before.
For much of the hour, the debate focused on the accuracy of studies linking past abortions to infant prematurity, rather than what it might mean for schools to have to teach the concept to students. Two members of the audience spoke after McCaffrey, saying he was selectively choosing his science. A physician who took issue with McCaffrey happens to be a colleague of his at UNC School of Medicine, professor of obstetrics and gynecology David Grimes. He called the bill both unnecessary and uninformed.
The World Health Organization, the CDC, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, the American Academy of Pediatrics, to which Dr. McCaffrey belongs, and the American Public Health Association all have uniformly concluded that abortion does not cause prematurity. How did they all get it so wrong? Third, even if the statement were true, curriculum content should be left to educators, not politicians unfamiliar with the literature.
The next speaker, Kay Phillips, heads the Adolescent Pregnancy Prevention Campaign of North Carolina. She says this would be a difficult law for schools to follow.
We understand the desire to reduce both numbers of preterm births and the number of abortions in North Carolina. Senate Bill 132 is unlikely to impact either health issue. It is, however, likely to create discomfort for our state's parents, students, and educators.
Democratic Senator Gladys Robinson agreed, saying it's possible for people on both sides of the abortion issue to find studies that back up their claims.
The information is out there. We can use whatever we want to justify why we want to do these things. But I think that we need to make sure the teachers teach what they are able to teach and educated to teach, and not go into other areas that they are not professionally educated to do.
Robinson introduced an amendment that would have removed the requirement that abortion be listed as a cause of preterm birth. The voice vote on the amendment sounded close, but the committee chairman, Senator Ralph Heiss, declared it had failed. The bill is expected to land on the Senate floor soon. I'm Jessica Jones.
Trade practices around the port city of Wilmington over the past century have caused a significant decline in the number of fish in the Cape Fear River. But thanks to the efforts of a local nonprofit, their populations are staging a comeback. Cape Fear River Watch riverkeeper Kemp Burdett says there are several reasons why fish numbers have dropped, but the main reason is the construction of three dams on the Cape Fear River in the early 1900s. The dams were originally built to facilitate trade and commerce between Wilmington and Fayetteville.
Barges would approach the dam and then move into a lock chamber adjacent to the dam. That chamber would be, you know, flooded or drained, depending on which way they were going, and then those boats would continue upstream.
While the dams were beneficial for navigating barges and vessels, they prevented migrating fish species like striped bass, American shad, as well as the endangered Atlantic sturgeon and short-nosed sturgeon from swimming upstream to spawn during the spring.
For American shad, for instance, we know we basically are at 10% of what historic levels were. 9 out of every 10 fish that used to be in the Cape Fear River are not there now. But none of these fish, none of these migratory species are even approaching the population numbers that would be considered healthy. So, you know, they all need help.
To help restore the natural migration of fish in the Cape Fear River, the Army Corps of Engineers constructed a fish ladder at Lock and Dam No. 1 in Regalwood last year. It's the first of its kind on the east coast of the United States. Fish climb the stair-step-like structure made from carefully placed rocks by leaping out of the water level by level until they're over the 12-foot-high dam. It's the first migrating season since the fish ladder has been in place, and Burdett says it's being used.
The Division of Marine Fisheries has tagged fish with sonic tags. Then they've gone out and collected this data. Studies show that fish are using these fish passages. Striped bass and shad are both using the fish passage. They're both moving upstream for you know, unassisted for basically the first time in 100 years. So it's a really significant breakthrough for the Cape Fear River and for the migratory fish in the Cape Fear River.
Now, two more fish ladders are in the planning phase. Two grant applications were recently submitted to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration to fund the design, construction, and monitor rock ramp fish ladders at the other dam locations on the Cape Fear River. While one project focuses on helping migrating fish travel upstream, another project currently in the works will help restore breeding habitat. Coastal scientist Dawn York explains the project.
And basically the premise is to design a site in which we can place about 1,000 tons of rock down in an area that will help enhance spawning habitat for American shad.
York is with Dial Cordy and Associates, an independent environmental consulting firm working with the Cape Fear River Watch, as well as state and federal agencies, on creating the fish habitat. She says the rocks will be placed at a half-acre area downstream of Lock and Dam No. 2. An exact location for the habitat hasn't been decided. Crushed granite, ranging in size from 2 to 10 inches, will be set at the bottom of the Cape Fear River, providing a safe place for striped bass, herring, and sturgeon to lay their eggs. York says a dredging company in Wilmington will help facilitate the construction.
You know, they'll travel upriver. It will take about 4 to 5 days to mobilize to Lock and Dam 2. They'll use their excavator and smaller equipment to get the material onto the spud barge, and they can handle about 90 tons per day. So we're anticipating that construction of the restoration habitat will take about 4 to 6 weeks.
York says they want the first and last ton of granite material to be hand-tossed into the water by volunteers.
The rest of it will then be handled by spud barge and mechanical means, basically an arm that will come down and grab large handful of material and place it into the river. It's going to be sort of spaced out over a half acre, so it's going to be sort of a flat area.
Construction should take place between December of this year and February 2014. The project can't begin sooner because of a moratorium banning the placement of material in the water due to fish migration. Cape Fear River Watch Riverkeeper Kemp Burdett says the next several months will be spent finding the best location for the new fish habitat.
Not nearly as simple as taking rock out there and dumping it off. It's really what we're going to do is we're going to, and we've already started to do this, side scan sonar assessments of the riverbed. And what we're trying to do there is understand what the riverbed looks like, what the substrate looks like, and identify, you know, the best places to put the granite.
Even with the project wrapping up in early 2014, Burdett says their work of repopulating the waters of the Cape Fear River with migrating fish species is far from over.
The project at Lock and Dam No. 1 was a huge first step, but it's not the last step. We still have two more dams that we need to have fish passage around, because we really need these fish to get up, you know, to the fall line. That's the area where they want to spawn. That's the area where spawning would be most successful. And so, you know, that's where we need to get them.
Even though the construction isn't underway, the project is already receiving national attention. The National Fish Habitat Partnership has listed the Cape Fear River as one of the 10 waters to watch for its locally driven conservation areas and ongoing efforts. Fishing is permitted at all three lock and dam sites. However, there is a moratorium on keeping striped bass. It is also illegal to keep sturgeon because they are an endangered species. A dock was recently installed at the Lock and Dam No. 1 downstream from the dam structure, and Burdett says it's a popular fishing site for shad. If you'd like to see pictures of the fish ladder in place at Lock and Dam No. 1 in Regalwood, go to publicradioeast.org. The Downeast Journal is made possible by our members in partnership with CCHC Imaging Center, introducing 3D mammography to this region, offering earlier detection of small breast cancers, accuracy in pinpointing size, shape, and location, plus fewer biopsies and additional testing. CCHC Imaging, 637-5480.
Hey, it's us, Click and Clack from Car Talk. It's spring, which means out with the old and in with the new.
You saying I should clean out my desk?
Yeah, if you can find it. Actually, I'm talking about new cars. If it's time for a new ride, donate the old one.
And support this station.
For more information on the vehicle donation program, visit publicradioeast.org.
Coming up this weekend, the Ratio Theater Company is having its fundraising event, Dancing with the Newbern Stars. It takes place Saturday night at 7 p.m. at the Sedan Shriners Auditorium in downtown Newbern.
That evening, they will perform live in front of the audience, so it really will be quite a show.
Andrea Owens is the managing director of the Ratio Theater and organizer of this weekend's event. The nonprofit Ratio Theater Company began in October of 2009 and is now in their fifth season. They perform four shows each year at the Coleman Performance Hall and the Tryon Palace History Center. Ratio Theater Company is made up of about a dozen actors and are the only professional theater company in eastern North Carolina. Owens drew inspiration for the fundraiser from the popular TV show Dancing with the Stars.
The committee all recommended stars, quote unquote, for our fundraiser, and they're all local people that you might have seen in the newspaper before.
The dancers for this Saturday's event include five local celebrities, including Gay Price, Linda Staunch, Rip Taggart, and others.
We have a 17-piece jazz orchestra coming. The Starlight Dance Orchestra will be playing for the Dancing with the Stars event. So there'll be dinner and dancing and the competition.
Earlier this week, we caught up with one of the Newbern stars, Nelson McDaniel. He's the president of the Newbern Historical Society and was the chairperson of the Newbern 300th celebration.
I'm practicing again, and I need to practice because I'm terrible.
McDaniel and his partner for Saturday night's event, professional dancer Joyce Price, have been practicing together for several weeks.
Well, it's based on a foxtrot with lots of little steps thrown in order to make me look foolish. Got about nine different steps, and it's to the Natalie Cole song, I Was Walking Along, Orange Colored Sky, which is a wonderful song. So I know the music will be good, even if the dancing's not, and Joyce will be good.
Each Newbern star participating had the opportunity to train with a professional dancer and come up with a routine to wow the judges.
We're going to be looking very closely to make sure nobody trips and falls down. That'll be very important.
Classical music host for Public Radio East, Finley Woolston, will be one of the judges for the Dancing with the Newbern Stars event. He says originality and the ability to express the music through dance are a couple things he'll be looking for.
In judging dance, what expertise do I have in judging dance? Absolutely none. I cannot dance. I've tried it many times over my life. I have great rhythm in my conducting arm and in my voice. I am a trained professional musician. But judging dance, no, not very much.
Nelson McDaniel says he has a plan of his own to win over the judges.
Throw myself on the mercy of the court, and if they have any desire to indicate sympathy, then they'll vote for me.
Dancers will perform their routine before a live audience and judges. A winner will be selected among the judges. Their vote will count 30%. And from now until the end of the competition, people can visit the Ratio Theater Company's website to cast their vote for their favorite Newbern star. That counts as 70% of the final vote. Event organizer Andrea Owens says a winner will be announced at the end of the event.
All the proceeds for the event will go to support Ratio Theater Company. They are planning new programs like the Theater for Young Audience program, which will take place in the park this summer, live theater on the stage in Union Point Park, along with their regular season that happens down at Coleman Hall in the Tryon Palace History Center.
The Ratio Theater Company's Dancing with the Newbern Stars fundraiser takes place Saturday at 7 p.m. at the Sedan Shriners Auditorium in downtown Newbern. If you'd like more information, go to publicradioeast.org.
It's going to be great fun. We've got people here well known in Newbern and professional dancers along with the amateurs, and I know that they're working their tail off to get ready for this. They really are. And it's supporting a really good organization, the Ratio Theater Company. They're doing great things for the arts, and it's going to be a lot of fun and a great organization. Get out there and support them.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. We all like having colorful flowers in our yards, preferably for most of the growing season. But it's really expensive to buy new flowers every year to put out in our beds. There is, however, an easy way around this. How about if you and your friends all share and exchange perennial flowers? Now, I always promote perennial flowers for your beds for one simple reason. You buy them once, and they keep returning flowers year after year after year. The individual plants are going to be more expensive than annuals, but when you think about them coming back year after year, they turn out to be less expensive in the long run. Now, it gets even better than that. Perennials, many of them, tend to multiply and expand in the garden. And that gives you the opportunity to dig them up in the early spring when they first show up and divide them with friends. And if each of your friends is digging up their spreading perennials and sharing them with you, well, you see where this is going. Everybody gets new beautiful perennials every year at no cost. When I was working in my yard this week, I noticed a few of my perennials that really need to be divided and shared. Sometimes I find myself just weeding out the extras, as I would, well, an unwanted weed. But I really should take the time and dig them out and share them with others. In my yard, I have a perennial chrysanthemum. It is a beautiful, small, salmon-colored flower that has gone from one tiny plant in a tiny pot to a patch 3 feet by 4 feet in a bed. I could easily dig parts of that chrysanthemum to share with others. Coneflowers, you'll find them dividing in the garden, coming up often from seed that has fallen from last year's flowers. My daisies are spreading. I need to dig them up and share. And the one that just gets away from me, the gara plants. That's the plant called whirling butterflies, with the beautiful, tiny flowers dancing on the ends of long, thin stems. They really attract bees. As far as herbs go, well, in my garden, I have oregano and mint, both of which have spread like crazy and that I could easily share with others. Now, you probably also have bulbs in your garden that can be divided and shared, but that's not something to do in the spring. Wait until fall, after the bulbs have bloomed this year and the tops have dried back, and then dig them out. Divide them up, replant yours, spacing them a little bit further apart to give them room to grow, and hand out some of those bulbs to your friends. So this year, rather than going out and buying flats and flats worth of annuals, try looking at perennial flowers, or at least flowers that reseed themselves. And then talk to some friends who also enjoy gardening and see if you can't come up with an annual plant swap in the spring of perennial flowers. I'm going to go dig a few of my guaras up and share them with a friend. And I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.
Thanks for listening to the Down East Journal. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for features, drop us a line at our website, publicradioeast.org.